Well, I know some of you have been going up and down the shortwave bands looking for the hour of the time earlier tonight. Well, we're here, and I'm William Cooper. About a little over a month ago, we received a call from Craig Smith to tell me that WHRI in South Bend, Indiana, was interested in broadcasting my program on their radio station, WHRI in South Bend, Indiana, and WHRI in Hawaii. And so we checked the frequencies, and they didn't sound too good at that time, to tell you the truth, and we relayed that to the management at WHRI. And they pursued me, ladies and gentlemen, pursued me, wouldn't let me rest, kept calling, wanted to get me on the air. So we talked, and we listened to some more frequencies at different times, had other people listen around the country. And then Craig Smith received a call from Joseph Brazier, who told Craig that he'd do anything to get me on the air. So we got on the phone and made a deal with him. One of the stipulations of the deal was that they would not censure in any way any of the content of my broadcast whatsoever. And we signed a contract for a 3-month trial period, after which time, if either one of the parties were not satisfied, we would terminate the contract and everybody would be happy. Well, folks, World Harvest Radio, WHRI in South Bend, Indiana, listened to 4 episodes of The Hour of the Time and got scared. Scared them to death. And they have canceled us on 7.315, 9.930, and on Galaxy 4, Channel 15, and all the different times that we were broadcasting. So, we're back on WWCR, the old stalwart defenders of the freedom of speech. George and I have our differences once in a while. But George, let me tell you something about George. He is not afraid. And as you know, neither am I. WHRI missed out in a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to air the best radio broadcast in the world on their station. Folks, we are the most popular, most listened to shortwave broadcast in the world, bar none. They missed an opportunity to help us make history by broadcasting the truth to the American people and the rest of the world, and they got scared. Scared. And that's what's destroying this country, folks, is people afraid. You see, if everybody's afraid, nobody will ever air the truth. And that's one way of controlling the media. In fact, it's the best way to control the media. People are more easily controlled through fear than through any other method that there is. Second best is money. If you can't scare them, buy them. Well, I don't believe that anyone bought WHRI, but I do know from talking to them that they're scared to air this broadcast. And that's okay, because I've been scared in my life until I made peace with death. Now I'm no longer afraid. Nothing can scare me now, and nothing ever will. And I will continue to broadcast the truth to whoever wants to listen on whatever medium that will carry this broadcast. And if at some future date WWCR should get scared too, then we'll figure out another way to do it. This is not my profession. It does not kill me to lose airtime. In fact, I never would be on the air at all if the socialist broadcaster Chuck Carter had not aired some disparaging remarks and then refused to give me 10 minutes to set the record straight. So that's why I went looking for airtime, and that's why I'm here with you tonight, folks. Now, since the ADL has declared war on the patriots in this country, including patriotic Jewish people, all people, in fact, who are patriots, who understand that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are the only thing that protect us from despotism, from the same kinds of things that happened to the Jews, to the Gypsies, to the Poles, to the Blacks, to the Catholics in Germany during World War II. And believe me, folks, the ADL is not Jews, and it is not a representation of the Jewish people. They serve their British masters only. They manipulate the Jews through lies and deception, through that old boogaboo anti-Semitism, by painting swastikas on walls, and by taking out parade permits for the Nazi party. Do you hear what I'm saying? Don't go away. I'll be right back, because I'm not going to wait for Monday. I'm angry. Patriotic Americans in this country of all races, religions, and creeds have been labeled as right-wing fanatic terrorists threatening to overthrow the United States government, and it is a lie. The label has come from the ADL. We have been called racist and anti-Semitic, and it is a lie. Before I go any further, I want to thank all of the Jewish patriots in this country who have called me and faxed me with their support in this effort and their denouncement of the ADL. And since the ADL is so powerful, I can't tell you who these people are, because I don't want them to get a visit in the middle of the night. For the ADL is also a pack of goons and terrorists who have been known to perpetrate violence on several occasions. Don't go away, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight, you're going to hear the truth for the first time in your life about the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. And you're going to hear it Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday of next week. And if necessary, on and on, until you understand just exactly who these people are. Thank you. What is the ADL? The Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith proclaims itself to be a non-profit corporation designed to eliminate defamation of Jews and other religious and ethnic groups, to advance proper understanding among all peoples, and to preserve and translate into greater effectiveness the principles of freedom, equality, and democracy. This statement is taken directly from the bylaws of the ADL of B'nai B'rith as amended by the National Commission June 1982. And nothing, dear listeners, could be further from the truth. In repeated flagrant violation of Section 501(c)(3) of the Internal Revenue Service Codes, the ADL operates as a tax-exempt public interest corporation. While in reality, ladies and gentlemen, it engages in a wide range of activities that are inherently criminal in nature, including interference in the judicial and law enforcement process, support for domestic and international terrorist organizations, instigation of hate crimes, espionage, support for suspected international narcotics traffickers, unregistered political activities, and covert activities on behalf of both hostile foreign governments and United States government agencies generally linked to the international social democracy. It is a matter of historical record that before, during, and immediately after World War II, the Anti-Defamation League functioned as a covert action arm of the British Special Operations Executive under its North American chief, Sir William Stevenson, in close liaison with the Federal Bureau of Investigations Division 5, the division that I have named as being implicated in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Through its 151-member National Commission and its paid staff maintaining regional offices in 31 cities in the United States and a number of locations in Europe, the Middle East, Ibero-America, and the Soviet Union, in fact, a Moscow office is in the process of being opened at the invitation of President Mikhail Gorbachev at the time this report was written. The ADL operates as a covert strike force whose corrupting influence extends into the pores of the financial community, the legal establishment, the media, and the United States government at the federal, state, and local level. And everything that I am stating tonight and will state in the following nights have been proven, can be proven, and is a matter of fact. And most of it is in the public record. Above all else, ladies and gentlemen, the ADL is a public relations front for that branch of American organized crime founded by Meyer Lansky during the early decades of this century under the patronage and sponsorship of leading Anglo-American financial interests. American Defamation League officials, for this reason, were reportedly deeply dismayed when a man by the name of Lyndon LaRouche dubbed the ADL the American Drug Lobby. More recently, the ADL has moved to deepen its ties to the Soviet foreign intelligence services operating in the West and in the newly liberated nations of Central Europe. The ADL, folks, according to its bylaws, is run by a national commission which currently consists of 151 members. It is chaired by a national chairman, currently Abe Foxman. The National Commission formally meets once each year. According to Article 7 of the bylaws, according to Article 7 of the bylaws, in the interval between the National Commission annual meetings, the ADL's National Executive Committee acts for it. The NEC is composed of a chairman, a senior rabbi at Temple Emmanuel in New York City, and vice chairman. The elected officers of the National Committee, the president, executive vice president, and honorary past presidents of B'nai B'rith together with their counterparts from B'nai B'rith women, the appointed chairman of all of the ADL standing committees, and the president of the ADL Foundation, together with 15 additional members of the national committee who are elected by it. The ADL is formally affiliated with B'nai B'rith, which is the Jewish arm of the southern jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. However, this link is principally maintained through the B'nai B'rith's representation on ADL's National Commission. Unlike its parent organization, the B'nai B'rith, the ADL is not a membership organization. In other words, you cannot join the ADL, as many Jewish people erroneously believe. You cannot join the ADL. Membership is by nomination or invitation only. In this sense, the ADL bears a greater likeness to the secret lodges of Freemasonry than its B'nai B'rith parent organization, which was originally conceived in the mid-19th century as a Jewish branch of British Freemasonry. Remember, British intelligence and the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry was behind the Civil War. You see, it was okay for the states to secede from the Union, but it was not okay to fire upon a United States fort. The current president of B'nai B'rith is Seymour D. Reich, a long-standing activist and officer of the ADL prior to his election to head B'nai B'rith. And that's not correct, folks. I'm reading from a report. It is now Abe Foxman. Of the current 151 active National Commission members, a smaller core group directs the overall activities of the ADL's staff through participation in standing committees of the National Committee. The standing committees are organized in precise parallel to the ADL staff divisions and departments, thus permitting the maximum flow of marching orders and other inputs from the National Commission into the day-to-day activities of the League's paid employees. In this sense, Edgar Bronfman and other leading national commissioners run the ADL. Standing committee chairmen of the ADL, who together with their committee members are appointed by the national chairman, include Howard P. Berkowitz, Planning, Donald R. Mintz, Civil Rights, Michael Nachman, Community Services, Sherwin Neuer, Budget, Melvin I. Salberg, Communications, Michael E. Schultz, Administration, Joel Sprayrigan, and Lucille Cantor, International Affairs, David H. Strassler, Intergroup Relations, Robert G. Sugarman, Leadership, and William Veteran Development. These committees, ladies and gentlemen, correspond to the divisions of the ADL's full-time staff, and the divisions include the following. Administration, concerned with the ADL's internal affairs, it is directed, or was directed, by Philip Seamus, who had previously been controller for the American Jewish Committee. The Civil Rights is a division that works through departments on fact-finding, research and evaluation, legal affairs, a Washington, D.C. office where a task force on Nazi war criminals is based, and four regional area coordinators. Community service, this division directs the 31 regional offices throughout the United States, whose directors work closely with regional boards appointed by the National Committee. Communications handles public relations and the production of material. Until January 1990, its director was Lynn Aniello. And I'm not sure that I pronounced it right. It's spelled I-A-N-N-I-E-L-L-O. Development. It oversees the fundraising activities of the ADL appeal. Intergroup relations is made up of departments on education, higher education, campus affairs, interfaith affairs, television, radio, and film publications. Television, radio, and film publications. Television, radio, and film publications. And an International Center for Holocaust Studies. International affairs compromises departments in the United States concerned with European, Latin American, and Middle Eastern affairs, and yes, I meant compromises, and is in charge of ADL's overseas operations, including the offices in Paris, Rome, and Jerusalem. Leadership recruits potential future leaders and coordinates an ADL National Leadership Conference. The ADL, ladies and gentlemen, has over 300 people who hold leadership or honorary leadership positions. Among this list are a number of honorary vice chairmen who are closely linked to the ADL, but who for various reasons, including government service, cannot serve as active officers. This group includes Senators Rudy Boschwitz, Republican Minnesota, and Howard Metzenbaum, Democrat Ohio, former Carter Administration Secretary of Commerce Philip Klecznik, former Reagan Administration Arms Control Negotiator Max Kampelman, and former Senator Abraham Ribicoff, Democrat Connecticut, and Representative Sidney Yates, Democrat Illinois. World Jewish Congress President Edgar Bronfman is also an honorary vice chairman, along with two other major crime figures from the old Meyer-Lansky orbit, bankers Leonard Abetz and Theodore Silbert. With the exception of the members of Congress, all of those that I just read off are honorary vice chairmen and were, at one time, active National Commission members. Among the active core of ADL operatives are Burton S. Levinson, ADL National Chairman since 1987, and his work with ADL dates back to 1950, when as a student at Los Angeles City College, he infiltrated a group affiliated with Gerald L.K. Smith. Now he is a senior partner in the Beverly Hills-based law firm of Levinson and Lieberman. Abraham H. Foxman, who is now the head, the ADL National Director since 1987, he has worked on the staff of the ADL since 1965. He was born in Baranowitz, Poland in 1940. Foxman is one of the most mysterious figures in the ADL leadership. United States intelligence sources and even some top-ranking ADL members reportedly suspect Foxman may be a Soviet illegal, a long-term penetration agent operating without any links to the official Soviet diplomatic corps. Arnold Forster was associate director of the ADL under Ben Epstein since 1946 and is now a member of the National Committee and ADL General Counsel. He has been of counsel with the New York law firm of Shea and Gould, a firm intimately tied to the late mob lawyer Roy Kahn. Kenneth J. Bailkin, this former ADL national chairman from 1982 to 1986, is today an honorary chairman and national committee member, as well as president of the ADL Foundation. Theodore H. Silbert, an honorary vice chairman. He works with Edgar Bronfman and the lucrative Greater New York Appeal for the ADL. Silbert is chairman of the Sterling National Bank. Burton M. Joseph, ADL National Chairman from 1976 to 1978, is today an honorary chairman. His family runs the Minnesota-based agricultural products firm I.S. Joseph. After World War II, Joseph teamed up politically with liberal Democrat Hubert H. Humphrey, through whom he became friends of Max M. Kampelman, now ADL Honorary Vice Chairman, and ADL top funder Dwayne Andreas. Together, they formed the Indianapolis ADL Mafia. Edgar Bronfman, ADL Honorary National Chairman and head of its Greater New York Appeal. Irwin Sewell, since 1966, he is head of the fact-finding department of the ADL's Civil Rights Division. Meyer Eisenberg, ADL Vice Chairman and former head of the National Commission's Civil Rights Committee with oversight over the fact-finding and legal departments. He served from 1959 to 70 as an attorney with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, attaining the position of Deputy General Counsel of the SEC before his retirement from government. In private law practice with a string of Washington, D.C. area firms, Eisenberg remains one of the nation's experts on securities law. It was no public relations gaffe when in 1985, the Anti-Defamation League gave its Torch of Liberty Award to gangster Morris Dalitz, founder of the notorious Purple Gang and longtime crime partner of the late mobster Meyer Lansky. The present leadership of the ADL is dominated by figures with long-standing ties to organized crime, particularly to the international drug money laundering apparatus. Foremost among these contaminated ADL officials is Kenneth Baelken, the ex-national chairman who is still an honorary national chairman and a director of the ADL Foundation. While with the New York law firm of Wilkie Farr and Gallagher throughout the 1970s, Baelken masterminded Robert Vesco's looting of Investors Overseas Service, IOS, of more than $60 million. Vesco, the fugitive financier now living in Havana, Cuba, was an early partner of Medellin cartel dope smuggler Carlos Leder Rivas, helping Leder to set up his marijuana and cocaine smuggling routes through the Bahamas. On April 17, 1989, Robert Vesco was again indicted by a federal grand jury in Jacksonville, Florida, which charged him with involvement in a Medellin cartel cocaine smuggling conspiracy from 1974 to 1989. In January 1980, a jury in the U.S. Southern District of New York ordered Wilkie Farr and Gallagher to pay $35 million to victims of the IOS looting and found that Baelken had been instrumental in structuring the money laundering and theft scheme at every level. Law enforcement officials believe that IOS was one of the early conduits for billions of dollars in drug profits and was a cash repository used by Meyer Lansky. Recently, Baelken left Wilkie Farr to join the country's largest law firm, Skadden Arps, in much the same way that Wilkie Farr pioneered the elaborate offshore money laundering schemes that today constitute the bloodstream of the international drug trade. Skadden Arps pioneered the junk bond and leveraged buyout schemes through which billions of dollars in dubious offshore money have been repatriated through hostile corporate takeovers and asset stripping of America's industrial sector. Two of Skadden Arps' most notorious clients are Drexel Burnham's Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky, both of whom, not coincidentally, have been ADL contributors. Another ADL national chairman, Burton Joseph, played a pivotal role in the Robert Vesco takeover and looting of IOS by putting Vesco into contact with his protege, financier Meshulam Ricklis of the Rapid American Corporation. Ricklis, according to court records, purchased a controlling block of IOS stock as a surrogate for Vesco. Ricklis was later linked to Baelken, Edgar Bronfman, that's Bronfman, Henry Kissinger, and other Anti-Defamation League figures in a real estate scandal involving the illegal purchase of large tracts in the Israeli-occupied territories and Christian and Muslim sections of Jerusalem. During Baelken's tenure at Wilkie Farr, the firm also handled pro bono legal work for the Anti-Defamation League and represented major Anti-Defamation League donor and suspected crime figure Edmund Safra. Baelken represented Safra in the Syrian banker's takeover of American Express, a transaction that ended years later in a fiasco with American Express officials accusing Safra of money laundering. On January 3, 1989, officials of the United States Customs Service and the United States Drug Enforcement Administration in Bern, Switzerland, identified Edmund Safra as a major figure in an international drug money laundering scheme involving the Shikarchi Trading Company. The government reports identified Safra as a lifetime friend and business associate of Mohammed Shikarchi, and identified numbered accounts at Safra's New York City Republic National Bank as pass-through accounts for drug profits from Syrian, Lebanese, Bulgarian, and Colombian trafficking organizations. Now, according to aides to Safra, he arranged that the ADL receive $1 million from money he won in a lawsuit in 1989. There is one financial institution that is more closely linked to the ADL than any other, Sterling National Bank of New York City. On January 29, 1982, Italian authorities filed civil suit against Sterling National Bank and other U.S. financial institutions on behalf of depositors in Banca Privata Italiana, charging that $27 million had been looted. Don't go away, folks. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, the Hour of the Time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading. They specialize in non-confiscatable, non-reportable, hard assets. The type of assets that you're going to need when the plug gets pulled here to bring about the New World Order. You see, they have to have a redistribution of wealth. They have to get rid of the bourgeoisie, the middle class, and that's you, and that's me. They have to have, in the end, just two classes of society, the rulers and the ruled. And, of course, everybody will be led to believe that everybody is the same, that there are no classes, and that socialism really works, when, in fact, it's one of the greatest scams in the history of the world. Only precious metals in its various forms are going to help you during these trying times. Call 1-800-289-2646 and do it right now, folks. That's 1-800-289-2646. 2646. Tell them that you want to find out how to survive what's coming. Ask for their recommendations. If you already have something in mind, tell them what it is. They'll do everything they can to help you achieve your goal. 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did. The chairman of Sterling, both at the time of the alleged theft and today, is Theodore H. Silbert, another honorary vice chairman of the ADL and the former head of the ADL Appeal, its major fundraising arm. Law enforcement sources have identified Sterling National as a mob front since its founding in 1929 by Meyer Lansky. Associate Frank Erickson. You understand what I'm saying, folks? These people are solidly and completely linked to organized crime. Meyer Lansky's associate, Frank Erickson, founded Sterling National as a mob front. Sterling National was also implicated in a tax evasion scheme in the early 1980s through another ADL-linked bank director, Arnold Burns, a Reagan-era U.S. Deputy Attorney General. Burns' law firm, Burns and Summit, apparently set up a string of Caribbean tax shelters which shielded millions of dollars in taxable income through non-existent R&D investments in Israel. Former Reagan official, Ambassador to Italy, Maxwell Raab, is another long-standing Sterling National Director. Raab was a one-time business partner of Meyer Lansky in the International Airport Hotel Corporation. Yet another mob-linked banker who sits on the ADL's National Commission and is listed in the League's most recent purpose and program as an honorary vice chairman is Leonard Abess of the City National Bank of Miami. In 1981, Abess bought Colombian cartel money launderer Alberto Duque into the bank's board, where he remained until he was jailed on money laundering charges in 1986. The following year, Donald Beasley was named City National's chairman. Beasley was the former director of the Nugan Hand Bank, believed to have been a major laundering conduit for Southeast Asian heroin proceeds, as well as black funds derived from the illicit arms trafficking of Theodore G. Shackley and other former top Central Intelligence Agency officials later implicated in the Iran-Contra scandal, and I wrote about the Nugan Hand Bank in my book 5 years ago. A listing of ADL financial contributors and award recipients over the recent decades reads like a who's who of the Meyer Lansky International Crime Syndicate. Longtime Lansky cronies such as Victor Posner, Hollywood attorney Sidney Korshak, and Mo Dalitz all appear as ADL patrons. The same pattern holds true at the regional levels of the ADL. For example, Phil Baskin, a Pittsburgh attorney and Democratic Party fixer known to be the chief operator of the ADL in western Pennsylvania, was forced to resign as the senior partner in his law firm after being implicated in an effort to deliver a major airport construction contract to a top figure in the New York City Gambino family, Nikki Sands. Further south, Paul Lipkin, the chairman of the Virginia Regional Board of the ADL, was for decades the personal attorney for Arthur Bootsy Goldstein, the biggest pornography distributor in Norfolk. Goldstein was arrested 85 times and served 3 jail terms for crimes including selling glue to minors and peddling sex paraphernalia. No discussion of the ADL's ties to organized crime and the drug apparatus would be complete without reference to Edgar Bronfman, ADL honorary vice chairman and chief of its New York appeal. Today, touted as a leading international businessman, philanthropist, and the chairman of the prestigious World Jewish Congress, Bronfman has been unable to erase the taint left by the fact that his entire family fortune, Seagram's Corporation, its majority share in E.I. DuPont, De Nemours Company, etc., derived from his father's Prohibition-era bootlegging activities. Known at the time as the Bronfman Gang, the Canadian Bronfmans were the main illegal suppliers to America's crime syndicate known as Murder Incorporated. By no later than 1920, when Edgar's father, Sam Bronfman, and Arnold Rothstein, Agent Jacob Katzenberg, were dispatched to Hong Kong to arrange opium supplies, the bootlegging routes were also utilized for the smuggling and retail distribution of illegal drugs. To this day, elements of the Bronfman family remain tied to the gutter levels of organized crime, while Edgar and his brother and cousins have managed to wrap themselves in a somewhat ragged cloak of respectability. Edgar's nephew, Mitchell Bronfman, was named in a 1972 Montreal Crime Commission report as an intimate of local crime boss Willie O'Bront. Their relationship extends into illegal activities in which they have mutually or jointly indulged, the special kinds of favors they did for each other, and the resulting advantages of each in the fields of loan sharking, gambling, illegal betting, securities, tax evasion, and corruption. Taken directly from a book entitled The Bronfman Dynasty by Peter C. Newman. O'Bront and another Mitchell Bronfman crime partner, Sidney Rosen, were both jailed in the mid-1970s for drug money laundering and related crimes. When in 1978 the links of the Bronfman family to organized crime were published in the book-length study of the international illegal drug trade entitled Dope Incorporated, I advise all of you, everyone listening, purchase the book entitled Dope Incorporated. That is Dope Incorporated. This book was commissioned by the LaRouche organization, and the research was done by the Executive Intelligence Review. The Citizens Agency for Joint Intelligence and the Intelligence Service have duplicated the research long ago. You remember, folks, we did a five-part series on the ADL already once before. Bronfman, according to Quebec police sources, ordered his attorneys to prepare a multi-million-dollar libel suit, but after careful deliberation, the attorneys strongly argued against such an action. Instead, Bronfman reportedly poured large amounts of money into the Anti-Defamation League. Almost immediately, the Anti-Defamation League began a shrill publicity and dirty tricks campaign, slandering LaRouche as an anti-Semite and demanding his elimination. They eventually framed him and sent him to jail. He is free now. He has been released. He has documented his frame-up. The facts say that Lyndon LaRouche, no matter what you think of his politics, was innocent. He was put away because he did what I'm doing tonight. He told the truth about the ADL. In its March, April 1990 edition, the West German magazine, Semit, self-described as the independent Jewish magazine, published a blistering expose of ADL Honorary Vice Chairman Edgar Bronfman's dealing with the now-toppled regime of East German communist dictator Erich Honecker. The article by Jacob Dachauer, entitled, quote, A Whiskey for the Holocaust, end quote, documents how Bronfman used his post as president of the World Jewish Congress to make deals with the Honecker regime on behalf of his Seagram's liquor empire, and it's accompanied by a picture of Bronfman receiving the highest state medal of People's Friendship in Gold from Honecker in October of 1988. The essence of the Semite expose is that Bronfman used his credentials as head of the once respected World Jewish Congress to absolve the German Democratic Republic of any responsibility for the wartime Holocaust, in return for a series of lucrative concessions to market his whiskey in the German communist paradise. If you're a Jewish patriot, I hope you were listening to that. As the Executive Intelligence Review has reported, Bronfman's courtship of the Honecker regime began in 1986, when an associate of his traveled to East Berlin to meet with Klaus Geisy, the communist regime's Secretary of State for Religious Affairs. Klaus Geisy's son is Gregor Geisy, the reformer successor to Honecker as chief of the SED Communist Party, now called the PDS. In subsequent trips, Bronfman met with Honecker and SED Central Committee member Hermann Axen. During one visit in 1988, Bronfman pledged that he would personally arrange a state visit to Washington, D.C. by Honecker by 1990 at the latest. Subsequent events, of course, made that impossible. Edgar's brother and business partner, Charles Bronfman of Montreal, became a prominent figure in Canadian East German friendship groups and had veto power over all GDR visas issued to Canadians until the collapse of the communist regime in November 1989. These extensive GDR links have led some intelligence analysts to conclude that Edgar and Charles Bronfman have especially close ties to General Marcus Wolff, the head of the East German, and I can't even pronounce it, but it's called Stasi. Stasi. That's the East German Intelligence Service. And also to a leading protege of the late KGB and Soviet Communist Party boss, Yuri Andropov. Edgar Bronfman enjoys equally close ties to the regime in Moscow, and those links have grown even firmer since the accession to power of Mikhail Gorbachev in 1985. According to sources familiar with Bronfman's Russian links, the Canadian whiskey baron has been a longtime associate of Alexander Yakovlev, the former, excuse me folks, I still have a little flu here. That's better. I had to take a drink. a longtime associate of Alexander Yakovlev, the former Soviet ambassador in Ottawa, who is now one of Gorbachev's closest advisors. Was one of Gorbachev's closest advisors. Gorbachev is now in San Francisco at the Presidio, trying to bring about the one world government. Yakovlev sits on both the Politburo and the newly formed Presidential Council. In scores of speeches and commentaries written since Gorbachev rose to power, Bronfman has called upon the United States to grant the Soviet Union most favored nation status, membership in GATT, and access to the most advanced Western technologies. In a press release issued by his office on March 22, 1989, for example, Bronfman hailed Gorbachev for overturning socialism in one country, declaring, "It is in the United States' interest to prevent even a partial reversal of perestroika." Bronfman is a board member of the United States Soviet Trade and Economic Cooperation Council, called USTEC, a collection of American Fortune 500 executives and Soviet trade officials actively pushing expanded trade between the two superpowers. According to a United States State Department document, the Soviet delegation to USTEC is known by the CIA to be dominated by KGB and GRU, which most of you don't know about. It is the Soviet military intelligence operatives. Up until recently, the Soviet co-chairman of the group was KGB General Yevgeny Petrovich Petrovanov, a longtime Stalin ally who survived the post-Stalin shifts and became the head of the Soviet Chamber of Commerce. On January 23, 1989, syndicated columnists Evans and Novak reported on a secret meeting at Edgar Bronfman's New York City apartment, which also involved USTEC officials Dwayne Andreas and James Giffen, together with Morris Abrams and Simak Dinitz. The group reportedly hatched plans to mobilize Zionist lobby support for the repeal of the Jackson-Vanik Amendment in exchange for unrestricted Soviet Jewish immigration to Israel. The genesis of that scheme dates back to January 1985, when Edgar Bronfman, at the governing board meeting of the World Jewish Congress in Vienna, proposed that the organization oppose the Reagan administration's strategic defense initiative on Jewish grounds. When Bronfman also announced in April of that same year that he would lead the World Jewish Congress in an effort to prevent President Reagan from visiting a German cemetery at Bitburg during his state visit to the Federal Republic, Moscow reciprocated by inviting him to the Soviet Union in his official capacity as World Jewish Congress chairman. The invitation extended by Russian Federation Justice Minister Alexander Sukharev specifically proposed to discuss Soviet Jewish immigration. In similar gestures of support for Gorbachev, Bronfman has taken the point in forcing the resignation of the head of the West German Parliament, Philipp Jenninger, for a speech delivered in November 1988 on the 50th anniversary of Nazis' Night of the Broken Glass, anti-Jewish pogrom. In addition, at a widely publicized press conference in Budapest, Hungary, on May 4, 1987, Bronfman branded Austrian President Kurt Waldheim an essential component of the Nazi killing machine. Now, the charges against Waldheim were based largely on Soviet-forged documents and perjured testimony and were part of a major destabilization of Austria and the Vatican. No wonder Bronfman became a frequent commuter between New York and Moscow. You see, weeks after Bronfman's secret New York City planning session on February the 11th, 1989, Edgar Bronfman led the largest delegation of Jewish leaders to ever visit Moscow. On December 13, 1989, Bronfman was back in Moscow again, this time heading a delegation of 100 Western Jewish leaders to attend the opening of a Jewish cultural center, 1 week later, Kenneth Jacobson, the International Affairs Director of the ADL, announced that an ADL delegation would also visit Moscow in early 1990 to pursue President Gorbachev's offer to open an office in the Soviet capital. Next to Edgar Bronfman, Minneapolis grain merchant Duane Andreas, who participated in the Bronfman apartment meeting in which the Jews for Grain plot was activated, is the ADL patron most responsible for the deep ties between the League and the Russian regime. Although Andreas is not Jewish, he is one of the ADL's most generous donors. At a critical point in the late 1970s, when the ADL was financially on the skids, Andreas, at the request of ADL National Chairman Burton Joseph of the Minneapolis agricultural equipment firm I.E. Joseph, put up the seed money to establish the Anti-Defamation League Foundation. Andreas's relations with the ADL date back to his early political training by ADL National Chairman Ben Epstein, a relationship that Andreas described during congressional testimony in 1987 as, quote, "Mr. Ben Epstein, may he rest in peace, who was my friend for 20 years to his everlasting credit, was my mentor and guidance on the matters of diplomatic positions. I worked with him for weeks on this problem of how to expand trade with the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics," end quote. The September 26, 1986 Wall Street Journal, in a front-page piece titled "Gorbachev's Pal, Duane Andreas, Gains a Position as the Kremlin's Apparent Favorite," identified Andreas as the successor to Occidental Petroleum's chairman Armin Hammer, now 91, as the Soviet regime's favorite capitalist. Actually, Armin Hammer is no longer with us, ladies and gentlemen, and has been exposed as a raging communist. It was apparently Andreas, who has had more private audiences with Gorbachev than any other Westerner, who arranged the invitation for the ADL to set up shop in Moscow, ostensibly in order to help combat anti-Semitism inside Russia. A former State Department intelligence officer told the Executive Intelligence Review that the real purpose of establishing the ADL office in Moscow was to improve the Anti-Defamation League coordination with the KGB and running pro-Gorbachev propaganda inside the United States. Another feature of the ADL's current Go East push is the effort by Bronfman and others to move in on the lucrative new markets in the liberated nations of Central Europe on behalf of organized crime. For instance, the Canadian real estate billionaires, the Reichman brothers, represented by the ADL-linked law firm of Shea Gould and the ADL-linked investment house of Bear Stearns, are part of a new investment consortium seeking to establish a major financial hub in Budapest with the blessings of both Gorbachev regime and the United States State Department. ADL links to the Bolshevik regime and its intelligence services date back literally decades. Even during World War II, when the Soviet Union and the United States were allied against the Nazis, certain ADL officials were kept on United States military intelligence watch lists as suspected Soviet agents. According to one eyewitness account, Sanford Griffith, who headed the equivalent of the fact-finding division during and immediately following World War II, was on such a list. And if you'll remember, the ADL was caught spying not too long ago on American citizens, American groups, and even Jews. The April 5, 1955 issue of Headlines and What's Behind Them catalogs a controversial instance in which the ADL provided cover for a known Soviet intelligence agent. The Soviet agent in question, Vladimir Stepankowski, that's Vladimir Stepankowski, had been deported from France and Switzerland in the mid-1930s after having been identified as the head of the Bolshevik Information Bureau, only to migrate to the United States and immediately go to work for the Anti-Defamation League's Mitchell Solomon. through Solomon's ties to United States Army Lieutenant Colonel Eugene Prince, an intelligence officer in charge of immigration background checks, Stepankowski was able to penetrate American wartime intelligence operations. In 1954, he was identified by Elizabeth Bentley as a member of a Soviet spy ring. However, he was saved from prosecution through the intervention of his Anti-Defamation League case officer, Mitchell Solomon. By this point, the ADL had deployed the Soviet agent into the National Renaissance Party of Robert Madoff, a neo-Nazi counter-gang that had been set up largely by the Anti-Defamation League infiltrators in order to create the specter of a new fascist menace inside the United States in order to control Jews and keep them in line. According to the headlines account, the NATO group attracted a small core of members, principally on the basis of the Anti-Defamation League providing NRP founder Mado with a stable of prostitutes from the Mickey Jelky vice ring. Anti-Defamation League officials Ben Epstein and Arnold Forster then reportedly used Stepankowski's information to inundate the Veld Commission, that's the House Un-American Activities Commission, with scare stories that the NRP had swelled to 200 to 700 members in New York City alone. Joseph McCarthy was right, and this nation as a whole did him wrong. Good night until Monday, and God bless you all. Patriot, and I am proud of it. I have sworn to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign or domestic, and I fully intend to fulfill that oath. How about you?